But here we go for another podcast. And what we've done today, once again, for the second time, we've come into the studios of BBC Radio Northampton, in the centre of Northampton, historic Northampton, which is surrounded in itself by World War One heritage. But we haven't come to talk about that today. We've come to talk about two soldiers that came out of Northampton. One is very, very famous. Everybody knows him, Walter Toll. But at the end of the interview, we're going to talk about another soldier that perhaps a lot of people don't know. And the reason why I've come into Radio Northampton is to talk to Graham McKechnie. And we talked to Graham last year, I think it was, about Edgar Mobbs. And we've come to do the same again about these two soldiers. So hello again, Graham. Here we are.
Hello, yes. Yes. Thanks for having me back on. I'm looking forward to this.
Well, it went down well last time.
Good.
We had lots of interest in what we were talking about, Edgar. And it's amazing that Northampton, you know, we've got so many well-known stories and none are more well-known than Walter Toll for all sorts of reasons. You know, he was a sportsman. He overcome all sorts of difficulties in his life and racism and everything else. Where do we start?
Well, yeah, you're right. When I first moved to Northampton, given my interest and my background in sports and in the First World War, two of the best stories, the most well-known stories, are here in Northampton, Edgar Mobbs and Walter Toll.
And you knew about those before you came to Northampton.
Yeah, they're both... Yeah, that's such the power of those stories. And I think the difference is that Edgar Mobbs' story was known from day one, wasn't it? Mm. Whereas Walter Toll really wasn't very well known until Phil Vasili really was the one who brought it back to public consciousness in the 1990s. Mm. That even if you look back at the papers of the time, you know, when Toll died, there was hardly any mention. There was just a newspaper column and that was it.
Well, even when I was growing up in Northampton in the 70s and 80s, we didn't do it at school. I didn't know about him until, you know, like you said, 20 years ago, probably.
Yeah, and the difference is now my children have grown up and gone through the Northampton schools. Mm. He's taught now.
He's taught now, yeah.
So in that sense, he's a modern story, isn't he? Although more than 100 years ago.
Yeah.
And that's what, you know, there's so many aspects of this story which I find fascinating and uplifting. But when I first moved here, I remember talking to some local people that are interested in the First World War. And to be honest, there's a little bit of weariness about Walter Toll, a slight air of cynicism about the story amongst the, you know, the anoraks like you and me around here, because, you know, it's been done so much. And I understood that. Well, eventually I started to empathise a little.
Yeah.
But it's totally unfair, because every time I look at the story again,
there's something new, isn't
it? I'm blown away by it as well.
Yeah.
Walter Toll was the most extraordinary man.
Yeah.
Like Edgar Mobbs in a different way.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know if they ever met. They might have done.
Yeah, yeah.
But
oh, he was physically strong, mentally strong. He achieved so much. He was brave. But he was vulnerable at the same time, wasn't he? Because
incredible
of what he encountered
story.
In Italy.
Yeah. And
we better tell people who he is.
Well, yeah. Let's start from the beginning. I mean, when I talk in schools about Toll, because I often go around, you know, talking to primary schools especially about him, it's his resilience and his ability to keep bouncing back, which is jaw-dropping.
From early life, early stage in his life.
Right from the start of his life, he was dealt a bad hand.
Mm. What happened to him as a child then?
So, well, he was mixed race in Victorian England.
Yeah.
That's a bad start, isn't it? That is tough. That's a really tough start in a racist world to be born mixed race.
There's no doubt about that.
He was born in Folkestone in 1888, down in Kent.
Yeah.
And his father was a carpenter from Barbados.
Yeah.
His grandfather was a slave. From Barbados again. Whereas his white mother was from Kent. But he was born into poverty. So already he's got two things against him.
Yeah.
Poverty. And the fact he was born into a dual heritage or a mixed race family at a time when the world was racist. So that's a very tough start.
Yep.
Then his mother dies when he was only 7 years
old. 7 years old, his mother.
1895, he loses his mother and then he loses his father 2 years later. So he's now an orphan.
And there's no social services or welfare state to help. I
mean, if Dickens wrote this, you'd say it was melodramatic and over the top. Mm. You can't believe the start that he's had. He's an orphan now at the age of nine.
And he's got his brother and other siblings.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, Edward Toll is one of the great stories as well. I mean, we focus on Walter primarily because of his football.
Yeah.
But Edward Toll was obviously an extraordinary man in himself. You know, he went on to become one of Scotland's first black dentists.
Yes, yeah.
out of the poverty. These two.
It's in their blood, isn't it?
Oh,
it's in their blood.
Wouldn't you have loved to have met them? And that's what I always come back to about the Tulls. Incredible people. Anyway, Walter was. Walter and Edward were then sent to an orphanage at the age of 10 in Bethnal Green.
Yeah.
And.
So that's not a great place to be either, is it, at the turn of the century in Bethnal Green?
Well, no, it's not. But what the orphanage had was a football team.
Football team, yeah.
And that was the beginning of kind of the escape from the humdrum and the tough life, really.
Being in an orphanage.
Yeah. Walter.
And they're together.
Yeah, they are. But it was Walter who excelled at football. And so from a very early age, we've got team photos of him actually at the orphanage. And, you know, the other thing, of course, that always makes Walter stand out is not just his physique, but the colour of his skin, even on the black and white.
Even black and white, you can see it.
Yeah, you can. Yeah. So he started playing football at the orphanage, and he was excelled. And he was picked up by Clapton FC. Who were one of the leading amateur sides of the era. He was training as a printer at the time.
And that's Orient now, isn't it? Like not,
no, different team.
Different teams.
Yeah, Clapton FC. Right. There was Clapton Orient as well, but they're slightly different branch. Clapton FC were one of the leading amateur clubs.
Team.
He won the FA Amateur Cup. He won the London County Amateur Cup and the London Senior Cup. They were a very strong side.
Yeah.
And on the back of his success playing football for Clapton, he was scooped up by Spurs.
Yeah.
So the mighty Spurs, who even then were growing in reputation. You're not a Spurs supporter, I know, but we'll overlook that.
No, we can. In fact, I'm an Arsenal fan. We can forget for this particular episode.
But he was picked up aged 21, signed for Spurs for £4 a week, which is a lot of money.
A lot of money,
It's a decent signing.
Yeah.
He travels with Spurs, who were, you know, this famous flamboyant English side. They went to Argentina, they went to Uruguay. And another feature you'll know from these lives, these Edwardian lives, they did travel. You know,
I couldn't believe it when I read the book and saw he went all the way to Argentina.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. They travelled around the world. They spread the gospel of football. That's what they were doing, these pioneers. Yeah. Now, one of the features of his time at Spurs, you start to see the language that they use in the newspapers, which we're uncomfortable with because it feels so, you know.
We're looking at it over 100 years later.
Exactly.
Normal language at the time, isn't it?
Most of the language. and a lot of the language is not, you know, it's of its time and it wasn't particularly, ill-meaning.
No.
But so they often talk about him being coloured, the coloured centre forward they would talk about, or it was in the Weekly Herald. The Football Star says, "Our dusky friend with his clever footwork." This is the sort of language.
Yeah.
I mean, the reason is he stood out. That was distinguished
It's not
him.
Meant to be derogatory, is it?
No, it's not.
Not by that.
But the reality is he is, at this stage, an anomaly. He's very, very rare. He is a black professional footballer.
Yeah.
The first black professional footballer in the country, outfield player. There's a goalkeeper. Yeah, before
there?
That. But the first black professional footballer.
Yeah.
Now, if he had achieved nothing else in his life, he's done that.
Yeah.
Which makes him very, very special already. Yeah. But, of course, he achieves a lot more.
Yeah.
That's only
the start of it, isn't it?
That
really?
Is only the start of it. Yeah. And I say similar things with Mobbs. You know, if he had only done this, if Mobbs had only ever played rugby, he was Northampton's first England captain. Walter Tull was the first black professional footballer.
But he had problems there, though, didn't he, at Spurs?
Well, I mean, now, the other thing I'd say about the Walter Tull story, I don't profess to be an expert. I've read and I've studied.
Yeah,
Tull.
But you tell it so well. That's what we're sitting here.
I enjoy telling it. But the what I would say is that it has become a very political story.
Yeah.
Various people try and get have agendas about Walter Tull's story.
Some of them try and change history.
Yeah, they
don't
do.
They?
Inevitably, like with Mobbs, all these famous stories, they get embellished and they get twisted. So one of the things which is difficult is his departure from Spurs. So one thing you will read is
and the reasons behind.
Yeah, you will read that it was because of race. Mm. I just don't think we have enough evidence to say that.
Okay.
And if you look at the,
it's the Bristol City match, isn't it? That it keeps being quoted.
Correct.
Dan Ashton Gay.
Correct. But if you look at some of the other accounts at the time, there were critics questioned if he was fast enough or if he was quite good enough to play in the first division. The reality is he only played 10 times for Spurs. He scored twice before being dropped down to the reserves. The match you referred to, it's a famous match in October 1909, when they played down at Bristol City. And I will quote this report. I know it's quite well known.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
But it's interesting. I read a lot of sports reports from this era.
Yeah.
And they are, by and large, they stick to the facts. They don't give you much opinion. That's the way.
So this is an unusual
This
one,
is really, really unusual. So this is from the London Daily News in October 1909. He says, Tull has much to contend against on account of his colour. His tactics were absolutely beyond reproach, but he became the butt of the ignorant partisan. Once, because he floored Annan with a perfectly fair shoulder charge, a section of the spectators made a cowardly attack upon him in language lower than Billingsgate.
That's which is the fish market in London.
Exactly. Yep. The famous expression, language lower than Billingsgate. Yep. And he goes on to say, let me tell these Bristol hooligans, there were but a few of them in a crowd of 20,000, that Tull is so clean in mind and method as to be a model for all white men who play football, whether they be amateur or professional. So, look, that is strong. Those are strong
words.
They are
strong words, yeah.
From the critic.
And I always imagine Harry must have felt that day. Like 20,000, he must have heard these words.
Unquestionably. And that's the only time it's been reported.
Mm.
So what we don't know is how often...
Mm. And how it affected him. We don't know that. There's no evidence. So after that awful game down at Billingsgate, what happened then to him? Was that the end of his Spurs career at that stage?
Well, it was the beginning of the end. He played for the reserves before the famous Herbert Chapman. There you are, there's an Arsenal connection for you.
Yeah,
legendary Arsenal manager.
Got it back to the Gunners.
Yeah, there you are. I thought you'd be happy. Well, he signed Walter Tull for the Cobblers, for Northampton Town, and that was really where we come in.
He's paid a fee, hasn't he?
He paid a substantial fee.
We don't know what the fee was.
No, but we know it's substantial.
Not as much as what Harry Kane's going to be sold.
Probably not. Probably not. But he was a good signing, and he did really well for the Cobblers, who were a Southern League team. 110 appearances he made for them in three seasons, scoring 9 goals. And
What position is he playing?
Well,
compared to today,
you know what?
Midfield.
He was mostly midfield. Yeah, yeah. He moved around a bit. But
in my head, I've got him as a centre forward. But he's not, is he?
Outside right, they talked about him playing. Yeah. But he was a very popular figure at the Cobblers. I mean, I'll just quote. I enjoy quoting this account because you have to rely, obviously, on eyewitnesses.
We've got no film of him, have we?
There's no film of him. There's photographs. There's a cartoon. If I just hold that up, because of course back in the day, in this era, they drew pictures which would appear in the Saturday Night. So Tull to the fore, and you can see his powerful physique as well as his
dark
skin.
Well, he's leaving all the opponents behind him, isn't he?
Literally lying on the ground.
He's grounded them.
But this is one of his teammates wrote this a few years later. He says, memories of Walter Tull. Next we come to another hero, dark-skinned, massive in build, strong as a lion, was Walter Tull. If ever a man of his skin had red blood and a white man's heart, it was Wally, a half-back, certain to win fame for himself and his club, a whole-hearted and whole trier every game. For robust, perfectly fair shoulder charges, given with effect, he has not been replaced. For his hard head and long, low shot, we have often sighed. He goes on as well to talk about off the field, he was a gentleman and the best musician the Cobblers had in my time.
Musician as well?
Yeah, apparently so.
New stuff.
Yeah, this is no mean ability when one is associated for the long, weary hours of waiting, as is often a footballer's lot. I understand Wally expressed an opinion to Northampton friends that he was going back to the front as an officer, which we know that he was.
Yeah.
He was a gallant fellow.
That's a lovely phrase.
So, he was a very popular figure. I mean, we don't know, because there are no accounts of any racism from the crowds. We just don't know.
No.
It's not to say it didn't happen.
No.
But he certainly fitted in very, very well. He lived in Northampton, lived up at Rushton as well.
Yeah.
He played a little bit of cricket while he was up at Rushton too. But clearly it was football and at the County Ground, which is where they played at the time, where he made his mark.
Yeah, the County Ground, for people that don't know, was Northampton Town's old ground. And I think it was in the mid-1990s that they left there to go to Sixfields.
Yeah.
And it's where Northamptonshire County Cricket play now. And there's a big stand on the ground, on the actual pitch where the Cobblers used to play.
I'll show you. It's no good for podcasts, but there's a team photo which you can find if you look up from 1912-13 season of Northampton Town. And on the back row, you can just see the sheer size, the athleticism of Tull. His biceps are bursting out of his shirt.
He's not taller, is he, than the others?
No, he wasn't tall. But you can see, as I say, his biceps are bursting out of his shirt. I'll just mention a couple of other players in the team that he played with. There's Harold Redhead, was an amateur.
It's the anniversary of his death a couple of days
ago,
wasn't it?
Exactly right. Yeah, he was with the 6th Northamptons.
And he lived in Abington Avenue, didn't he?
He did. He was the son of a surveyor. Mm. He was badly wounded at Trones Wood in 1916, July 1916. He came back, recovered, came back to be killed in August 1918 on the Western Front. And then the captain of this team in 1912-13 is Michael Fred Lessons, who is not really remembered as well as he should be.
No, I've not heard of him before.
So Walter Tull understandably gets remembered by as the cobbler's figurehead.
Yeah.
But really, Fred Lessons was cobblers through and through. He'd played for the team for a long time. I think he's still third, maybe fourth, on their all-time top scorers list.
I should know him.
He moved around. He had a fiery temperament, ginger hair and fiery temperament.
Always fiery.
Always fiery. But he was player coach as well of the cobblers.
Oh, right.
And he was killed with the Northampton Regiment in September 18.
Right. Has he got a grave, can you remember?
He has, yeah.
Let's go and search that one out then.
Yes, do. I've been there. I took Jimmy Floyd Hasselbank over to see his grave when we were talking about Walter Tull a few years ago. But poor old Fred Lessons, not at all remembered, but really ought to be.
Well, we'll have to look into further than that. What we'll do with these photos that Graham's showing me, on the social media pages on Twitter and Facebook, we'll put them on there. And I'll also put them on the podcast page of my website, terrystours.co.uk, so you'll be able to see exactly what we're rambling on about here. So,
yes,
he's at Northampton. What happened next?
Well, the First World War happened next.
Ah,
so,
bit of a problem.
You may have talked about what happened to football in the First World War in the past, but I'll go over it a little bit again.
We've only touched on this. We're going to do a whole podcast about the Footballers Battalion.
Yeah, you should.
That's for the future. So,
well, it's very interesting what happened to football, and
it's controversial, wasn't it?
Controversial because
they carried on playing professionally.
When I'm talking about this to contemporary audiences in schools, especially, do you remember during lockdown? Professional footballers got whacked by politicians.
Mm.
They are an easy target.
They are
young, working class men with a lot of money.
Yeah.
And they were an easy target in lockdown, and they were an easy target in 1914.
Yeah,
from
yeah.
politicians, again, sticking
yeah.
their nose in.
Yeah.
Other sports stopped. Cricket stopped. Rugby union stopped.
Yep. Professionally, we're talking about.
Well, they stopped. Well, rugby union was amateur.
Yeah,
so they didn't
course,
have
yeah.
they didn't have contracts.
Yeah,
they didn't have to sign anything. They could just go and join the army.
Yeah, but they chose to.
Cricket stopped. Well, it was right at the end of the season anyway.
Yeah, yeah.
It was easy to stop
but football, rugby. It's the start of the season, isn't it?
And remember what people were saying in August 1940.
Over by Christmas.
Yeah. So why should a professional footballer give up his contract?
Yeah.
Some of them
yeah.
did anyway, but not many did.
Yeah.
And some of the clubs wouldn't let them go anyway.
No.
So there's more than a whiff of classism, I think, about what was going on. Horse racing carried on.
Oh, right, yeah.
Interestingly,
no one complained about
horse racing, but football became an easy target for politicians.
Yeah.
And I do think old scores were being settled.
Yeah.
Bear in mind, it's the professional working class sport. And there was still a bit of bitterness. You know, the game, well, rugby had split in 1895. Cricket had
Union
fudged
and
it. Yeah, professional and amateur.
Yeah.
Football had gone down largely the professional route. And there was a bit of score settling going on. I think, still.
Yeah.
So it was an easy target.
Yeah,
and they went after football in 1914. And football continued into 1915, the famous Khaki Cup final in 1915. Mm. So the Footballers' Battalion was the response. Lord Kincaid, wasn't it, was behind it. Mm. The response, football's response. Let's get professional footballers together to join, almost like a pals battalion.
Yep. It wasn't just players, though, was it?
It wasn't just players.
Supporters.
It was some players.
Match officials.
Exactly right.
Yeah.
And they played the matches, much like mobs with his seventh. They played matches.
They were very good, weren't they? Kept winning cups all over the place.
They were very good. And Walter Tull was one of the very first men to join.
Mm.
I mean, it's extraordinary, really. I remember when we took Jimmy Floyd Hasselbank over to tell the story, which was in itself an interesting experience.
Because and that's on YouTube, I think, isn't it?
Some of it
find
is.
Find that
yeah.
documentary on YouTube.
Jimmy knew nothing about the First World War because he's Dutch, and he was saying, I can tell you about the Second World War.
And the reason you took him was because of he was the manager of Northampton Town at the
correct,
time.
Sorry, yeah. yeah. And this was the centenary of Walter Tull.
Yeah.
And Jimmy's advisors had said to us at the start, Jimmy doesn't really want to talk about race. It's just not something he wants to talk about.
Mm.
Well, that didn't last very long. When you're doing the Walter Tull story, Jimmy very quickly wanted to talk about it. And one of the things that he talked about was, I cannot believe that Tull wanted to join the army, wanted to serve this country. These people who'd thrown racist abuse at him.
That's a good point.
And dealt him such a bad hand in life generally. Mm. He's one of the first to say, I'll go and
fight. Yeah, yeah.
Extraordinary, yeah, really, isn't it?
No, the reason is what we can't ask him, can we?
It is, but it is extraordinary.
Yeah.
But he was one of the first to go. December 1914,
yeah.
He joined the 17th Middlesex, the Footballers Battalion.
Footballers, yeah.
Yeah. Now, when I'm doing this talk in schools, I'll say to the children at this point, remember the 17th Middlesex. Remember that,
yeah.
Because it might come up later in this story.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So hold that thought,
hold
everybody.
That thought. He joined as a private soldier. His promotion happened pretty rapidly. He was between February 15 and July 15. He had three promotions, Lance Corporal, Corporal, Lance Sergeant. He went to France in 1915.
So he's had these promotions based on his basic training abilities.
But his, yeah, absolutely.
Because he's not gone abroad at this stage.
No, they went abroad in late 15, which is quite early for, you know, for volunteers.
For volunteers, yeah.
They served in various parts of France. They were around the Lens area, a good footballing area, aren't they? The mining areas.
Yeah.
First time I ever went with John Cooksey was when we were doing the stories, the Lens. I couldn't believe it. It's more like Barnsley than the Western Front.
Yeah,
they were fighting
right.
amongst the cottages.
Yeah.
Terrifying.
Yeah.
Weird, weird part of the battlefield. Anyway, the next thing that hits Tull is acute mania. Shell
right.
shock, as we call it.
Yep.
So another thing that's dealt him. He's been this brave man who's joined, brave as a lion. He's joined the British Army. And then in April 1916, he leaves for 6 months with acute mania.
And that just shows us, again, no matter how strong a man is, physically and mentally,
yeah.
if you're going to break down because of the...
It can break anyone.
Anyone at all.
Absolutely right. So it breaks Tull, but not for long. He's home for 4 months. Before he returns as last...
It could have finished him, couldn't it? He could have been discharged at that
But he goes
stage.
Back 4 months later.
4 months.
To the 23rd Middlesex, the other footballers' battalion.
Yep.
But one point to make there is that he didn't serve, or he didn't fight in the Battle of the Somme.
No.
Because that's something you
He's
will read.
It.
That's another of these myths you read about Tull.
Yeah.
He misses the Battle of the Somme.
Yeah, the timeline doesn't stack up for that,
does
it?
Exactly right. So he goes back to 23rd Middlesex as Lance Sergeant, and then...
Because the 23rd did serve with distinction in Delville Wood. I think this is where people get confused.
Correct.
And there's the Footballers' Memorial.
Tull was after that.
He's come along afterwards.
Just
where
misses
people get confused.
It. Just misses the Somme.
Yeah.
Then in November 1916, he applies for a temporary commission. Now, there is a document I've seen which suggests that he initially applied for West Indian.
British West Indian.
But the commission which he got... was with the 23rd Middlesex.
Mm.
So another unbelievable moment, because this is expressly against the law, isn't it?
Are you of pure European descent? Yeah.
Yes or no?
Yeah.
He's written no, and he's still made an officer.
But he's been turned down, presumably, and then he said, no, I'm not taking no for an answer.
Well, I don't know the sequence of events, but all I can tell you is that he says no on his form, and yet they take him anyway. Now, this is an interesting part of the Tull story, because... Look, you and I, we're two white men talking about this, and I'm conscious of that when I talk to schools.
Very much so, yeah.
But the as I said to you earlier, the story has been politicised. The British Army and British society was institutionally racist.
Racist,
there
definitely.
Is no argument about that. It specifically asks, are you a pure
That's
European
racist.
Blood?
Yeah.
And yet, within those institutions, there are individuals who are not.
Mm.
I think that's what you've got to remember.
That's what we mean by institutionalised racism.
Exactly.
It doesn't mean individuals, it means the organisation.
Society obviously thought differently about race than we do today. But within, you cannot label, which is what happens sometimes, you cannot label everyone within that institution
as
racist.
No, that's right.
Because commanding officers, senior officers, have seen past Tull's race and made and given him the
commission. They've looked at his ability.
Exactly. He must have been an outstanding leader of men.
Yeah, because he's broken through that invisible barrier.
Yeah, exactly. And he's leading white soldiers in an infantry battalion, and he's the first black man to do that.
They've got a report
to him. Another first.
Mm.
Another incredible moment. He's overcome his shell shock. He's overcome his prejudice, and now he's leading.
Overcome being an orphan, the racism in football.
You've just got to keep going back to that, don't you?
Yes.
How does this happen?
They're all stacking up, aren't they? There's half a dozen of them already.
He is the most remarkable man. Posted to the 23rd Middlesex Regiment, 29th of May 1917, having completed his training. Up in Scotland, by the way.
Yep.
Went back, saw his brother.
Yep.
Rangers claim they signed him. Now, I've never seen any documentary evidence.
No.
But I'm not going to argue with
no.
that.
No, okay.
Rangers claim, because up in Scotland, my cousin's a teacher in Scotland, and,
oh, right.
and he teaches Tull in Glasgow.
As part of the syllabus.
Yeah, he's become yeah. a part of their syllabus.
Oh,
the syllabus.
Right.
So I'm not going to bust them
in. He's your source.
Just in case, we'll keep him as a Rangers player. The other incident, which is worth mentioning, of his time in the army, the 1st of January 1918, there was an attack on New Year's Day when they were in Italy.
Yeah.
Tull led 26 men of C Company against to destroy forward posts of Austrians. He's in the advance party. After him, 327 more men would come through, but they were the first platoon over. It was a successful raid. They destroyed the weapons. They came back. He showed bravery and real initiative. But why this is so important? Well, for one thing, he led white men into battle, which mm-hmm. is significant. But also, there is arguments about the Military Cross.
This is where this Major Paul comes into it.
Well, there is, and says he deserved the Military Cross.
And
it?
Second Lieutenant Picard said that he'd been put forward for the Military
Correct.
Cross.
Correct. After he died.
Had certainly yeah. earned it, posthumously, it
well,
says.
Look, but for what it's worth...
You and can't again, have one now, can you?
Well, I mean, I agree with you, Terry. For what it's worth,
yeah.
I don't think you can posthumously.
Because no. what about all the others?
Well... What about all the others? And also, look, there is...
And you're changing history.
You look at what Tull did,
mm.
And you would say, without question, it deserves a military mm. cross. There mm. is there is no evidence that he was denied it because of race.
No, no.
We cannot... It may have been the case, but we can't say definitively.
But I've come across many, many situations where families have said to me, my relative was put forward for the Victoria Cross, Military Cross, DCM, for whatever reason, they didn't get it. But...
It's
no reflection on them.
No, it may have been because of race, but we can't say.
No, that's
but,
right.
But all I would say is that from whatever I've learned about Walter Tull over the years, I don't think it would have mattered to him.
No.
And you know what?
No.
He has had the last laugh in the sense that he is now one of the best known soldiers of the whole of the First World War.
Yeah.
It doesn't need an MC.
No, that's right. And I think from what you've told me and what I've read about him, what would have bothered him most of all during that day... was the 26 men that he was leading.
Yes.
That's what he was worried about, as an inspirational leader.
So I don't personally subscribe to give posthumous MC, because I think teaching him in schools is more important.
Yeah.
And that doesn't need the
That's
MC.
That's the legacy, isn't it?
He's got an incredible legacy.
Yeah, yeah.
So,
and we're doing this now. You know, again, it's part of his legacy. The fact we're sitting here talking about him.
Well, we talk about him posthumously because he died in March 1918, unfortunately.
And that's our next stop, though,
yeah.
isn't it?
So, around...
so whereabouts was this then?
Well,
is this because I read in a book that this was where the war memorial is.
The Franco-Prussian war memorial.
Is that the right place?
Yeah, pretty much spot on. If you stand...
This is on the main road between Arras going down to the Somme.
Yes, just north of Bapaume.
Yep.
So you've got Bifier, the village, and if you look down towards... Favreuil, is it?
Yes, that's right, yeah.
And
that's where they were coming back from.
Exactly, yeah.
Yes.
So there's, you know, it's the photograph which I took with John. It's looking down. You can just see the whites of the Franco-Prussian War Memorial. That's looking down towards the German advance, down the slope.
So that's looking east,
exactly.
West to east, yeah.
He wasn't leading an attack, which is, again, a myth which you read. He was not leading an attack. It was a withdrawal.
There was a counter-attack a couple of days earlier, I think, from memory. And I think this is where that confusion comes from.
Yeah.
Because they were on their way back, weren't they?
That was not the case.
No.
He left Italy in March 18. He was in France from the 8th of March, 23rd of March. They arrived in Albert. The 25th of March, they were around Bifier, as I mentioned there. And the Germans attacked, flooding forward across that.
This is the great German offensive of March.
Exactly
1918.
Right. So... Private Billingham was with him. He was a footballer himself, played for Leicester Foss. He was a goalkeeper. And he wrote...
He was at Northampton as well, wasn't he?
He was briefly, yeah. He was. He was with Tull. He says, Private Billingham was with Lieutenant Tull when he died from a shot wound through the head.
Right.
Another man carried Tull some distance to try to get him buried, but had to leave his body in order to
escape. He's left his body in no man's land.
Left his body in... Yeah, there's another description from Billingham.
Because they're risking their own lives, aren't they? To go and get his body back. They know he's dead.
Exactly. So Billingham, again, gives more details to one of the Northampton papers here.
Yeah.
He said, in a chat with Private Billingham, the Leicester goalkeeper, he told me that Lieutenant Tull of the Footballers' Battalion, whose death was such a blow to many friends, was killed by a machine gun bullet which entered his neck... and came out just below his right eye.
Mm.
So a retreat. He was hit moving his men back, organising his men, moving them back. Billingham was 30 yards from him when he was hit and was the first to go to his assistance. He lived only 2 minutes, and Billingham carried him some distance in the hope of securing him a decent burial, but had to leave him on the account of the German advance. So, the end of Walter Tull, lost in that field, and recorded on the Arras Memorial.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, actually isn't the nearest one. I've never been quite sure why he's on the Arras Memorial, but that's where his name ended up.
I think a lot of the names on there are the ones that died in the German advance of 1918. But does he have a grave?
Well, who knows?
Yeah.
Who knows? There have been relatively recent claims in there, but we'll never know.
No,
we'll never
know.
And so the focal points for Cobblers fans or football fans or just military people who are interested in military history and social history is the Arras Memorial. We've been there with Clark Carlisle, the Cobblers captain, a few years ago. We saw Jimmy Floyd as well.
Yep. What meant to them and hearing the story and seeing that?
Well,
did they express? We can look at the video, can't we?
Meant differently to how it means to us.
Yeah,
because we were talking about two black professional footballers.
Yeah, whereas two white middle-aged.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, speak for yourself. But no, it's everyone gets something different out of the story.
Yeah, definitely.
But, I mean, you remember Terry Angus playing for...
Yeah,
you know, Terry will talk so eloquently about this as well.
Just the radio.
Yeah, exactly. But they are in awe of what Walter Tull achieved.
Right.
Because he was a trailblazer. Mm. Just like Terry was then a trailblazer for Clark and Jimmy Floyd Hasselbaink.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, Terry went through the 80s when racism was awful.
I remember him playing.
But it was they are in awe of what Walter Tull did. And rightly so. He was the most extraordinary man.
And around Northampton, where we are now, we're surrounded still, aren't we, by Walter Tull's memory.
Walter Tull Way, there's a statue, there's a wall outside Six Fields.
Yeah.
Rightly so.
A garden of remembrance.
Yeah.
And in the Guildhall, there's a fantastic, not just of him, but some others in the Guildhall.
And Mobbs is in there as well.
That's right. It's opposite Mobbs. They're opposite each other. And they're life-size as well.
They are.
So you get an idea of what they look like.
It's well worth a visit. Yeah.
Definitely, yeah.
So that's Walter Tull.
But then... Then when we spoke about this a few weeks ago, you came up with a new name.
Well, this is a story that... this is a legacy of lockdown. So during lockdown...
When you had nothing to do.
I had lots to do.
You were still on air, weren't you?
We were, yeah.
But doing it from home.
There was a lot... Correct.
Yeah.
There's a lot of talk about Black Lives Matter. And I was looking, I thought, well, I am genuinely interested to know about the history of black sport in Northampton. Mm. And we knew about Walter Tull. And from a cricket perspective, in the 1940s, after the Second World War, there was a cricketer came over to play. Bertie Clark played 49 matches for Northampton. She was a West Indian who was a doctor.
Yeah.
They offered him the captaincy, in fact, so he's obviously quite a man. But I was struggling to find anyone from Saints, actually, from the Saints history. And, you know, 80s and 90s was about as far back as I went. So anyway,
you ought to say you are the Saints historian, aren't you?
I am.
Yeah.
Yes.
Amongst that's many things that you do.
One of my hats. So anyway, I was... it's funny, when you stop looking for something, you sometimes find it, don't you?
Yeah.
So I was going down to Saints. Saints got a big photo archive, which needs sorting, and it was a day of homeschooling. Lockdown was easing, so my son and I said, oh, I'm going to take you today. He's interested in this sort of stuff.
How old is he?
Well, he was nine at the time.
But he had no choice then,
he at least feigned interest. So we started going through some old Saints team photos, and amongst them there's a Saints team photo from 1902. It's the A-team, actually. So, again, I'll show this to you.
He's got the same kit on, isn't he?
These were green and black stripes in 1902. And this man here stood out. He's in the middle row on the far left.
Yeah.
And he's noticeably darker.
Yeah. You can see in the black and white, can't you?
Yeah, you can see. And then again in 1903, standing in the back row, there he is again.
And is that how you discovered him then, just by looking at that photo?
Well, we spotted him. And I said, you know, that's interesting. What's going on here?
You didn't know anything about this?
No, never heard of him before.
No.
But luckily, the team photo had names attached, because they don't always.
Yeah.
And the funny thing is, historical research takes months and months and months and months and months, and you can spend days looking for something and you get one sentence and you're happy. Mm. This story unraveled within an hour.
Oh, really?
It was unbelievable.
In the physical archives?
Online,
okay.
So he had his name on it. It said Frank Anderson, and it had under his name Honorary Secretary.
Right.
So he's the secretary of the A-team, the Saints A-team. So that means he's discoverable.
Yeah.
Anyway, the first thing...
He's left a trail, hasn't he?
He's left a trail. So the first thing, British Newspaper Library mentions you can go and buy tickets for a Saints game from Frank Anderson of Spring Lane. It gives his address. They're suddenly thinking, oh, this is all falling together.
Yeah.
Because now you can find him on the census.
Yeah.
Frank Anderson of Spring Lane. So we looked him up. And he lived in Spring Lane with his family. The earliest census has him there with his father Charles and his mother Eliza and his brother Harry. He was two at the time.
Yeah.
This was in 1871. And his father, it says, everyone else, you know, Spring Lane was just cottages.
In town.
Yeah, horrible. Proper Victorian slum, wasn't it?
Mm.
His father was a courier, so he dyed leather for the shoe industry. That is the lowest of the low. A horrible, tough job. Born in the United States, in Baltimore. So immediately he leaps out and you're thinking, well, because it's very hard to say. He looks different, but can I be sure? But the fact his father's born in Baltimore, whereas everyone else in that street are born in Northampton.
There's not many people from Baltimore in Northampton at any point.
Not many at all. So you're starting to piece together some interesting facts about him. His father, as I say, born in Baltimore. This is in 1881. They lived at Spring Lane in the yard, in the courier's yard.
A yard?
Yeah.
That doesn't sound great.
Not great, no.
There's some horses there as well, isn't there?
It would just be a tough, tough place to live. You find a few match reports of Frank Anderson playing for the A team in the 1890s. Mm-hmm. He married a girl from Hayford, Amy Thornycroft. That's a good old Saints name. There's a few Thornycrofts around.
Yeah, it was Harvey Thornycroft.
There was. They are distantly related. It's a very complicated family tree.
Yeah, yeah.
But
yeah.
Frank married this girl, Amy, and then he played a few games for the Saints in the 1900s, in the early 1900s. When there were injuries, he came in.
Okay.
So he starts appearing. He made his debut for Saints 20th of October 1900 against Coventry. By this time, he'd had a daughter called Ethel. Keeps playing a few games. And so his life is starting to be pieced together. He worked, we know his father was a courier. Frank worked in a shoe factory like everyone else. So, you know, apart from the fact he appears to be mixed race.
Yeah.
Fairly unremarkable story.
Yeah.
But there are things that start to, you know, you can piece together this life, can't you? That he gets married, he moves around town, Spring Lane. At one stage, things seem to be going up for him a little bit because he moves to a slightly nicer part of town. He's over in Long Buckby at one point, moving around, working in a shoe factory over at Long Buckby.
Which is not unusual. People did move
around
a lot.
Exactly.
Wherever the work was.
There's a lovely story, actually, which pops up at one stage where he gets arrested. Poor old Frank. And the rugby players...
He didn't tell me he was a wrong'un.
Well, he was briefly a wrong'un. So the newspaper report basically... I mentioned earlier rugby league and rugby union split in 1895, and it was a very, very hostile split.
Yeah.
And Northern Union agents, as in the professional agents from rugby league, as we call it today, targeted clubs like Saints, trying to sign their best players. Because this is a working club, Saints. They weren't wealthy men.
No.
So they were targets and they were ripe for picking. But the Saints players didn't like Northern Union players hanging around. So this is what happened in 1903, when it says here, the newspaper report, that... The sequel to the visit of the Northern Union agents in December was forthcoming in Northampton Borough Police Court yesterday when a number of footballers and their friends were summoned. John West, Albert West, both Saints players, and Frank Anderson, 23, were charged with violence and refusing to quit the Ram Hotel upon being requested to do so by the landlord, Herbert Gubbins. So Frank Anderson was charged with assaulting Thomas Pallister, Albert Bateman for assaulting Thomas Hughes, William Herbert Gubbins for assaulting Frank Anderson.
So they're in
they
a
were all fighting.
They've had a few beers.
They chased this Northern Union agent, apparently.
Yeah.
They found him at Franklin's Gardens. They chased him through Northampton. They eventually cornered him in this pub where there was a fight.
Where was the pub in town?
Well, it's the Ram. It's gone now.
Yeah.
It's just around the corner from here, near the Holy Sepulchre Church.
So if they've chased him from Franklin's Gardens, that's quite a mile or so.
They've been all over town, drinking as they go,
right.
I suspect.
Yeah.
A fight breaks out. They all accuse each other of punching.
In the end,
the case is dropped.
Okay.
You read it and basically...
So he's still got a clean record then.
Yeah. In the end, the judge says, or the police just say... Let's not bother here, lads. And they were all sent off on their way.
Yeah,
so
slap.
That was Frank, a brief appearance in the newspaper. Apart from that, we don't know much about his life.
Okay.
He gets involved in an incident on a train when he's attacked on a train on the way home to Long Buckby once, it appears in the newspaper. The man who asked him to vacate his seat, and he didn't, and he got punched for it. Right. So again, that may have been a race.
Yeah, there's no evidence, is there? Yeah.
But that was
yeah.
Frank. That was Frank's life.
And then World War One comes around for Frank.
Well, that's the interesting thing, isn't it?
Because he must have been quite old.
Yeah, he was born in 1878.
Yeah.
So the outbreak of First World War. What is he? 22 plus 14, 36. Quite old, isn't he?
Yeah.
So I got home anyway, going back to my story with my son. We got home and we know quite a lot about him.
Yeah.
I'll just have a look. I think he's probably too old.
Yeah.
But I'll just have a look. So you know what it's like trying to find it.
Yeah, you got to. Once you get home,
you
get straight
onto it. And you think you might be lucky and get a short service attestation. And sure enough, that pops up. A Frank Anderson. Well, it could be him. I'll have a look. Well, I was put off initially because it says his age is 30. So he's lied about his age.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
Everything else matches. Everything else matches. Even his address. This is
so
our
you know
man.
You got the right man.
This is our man.
Yeah.
Now.
So who's he joined?
I'm going to show you this now, because this is what I show the school children. Do you remember what I said to you a while ago, kids? Which battalion to remember? So I remember looking at this, and across the top here, can you see? It's just got a splodge of ink over it. It says the corps he's joined is, what does that say?
Is that the 17th?
It just says Middlesex Regiment. But above it is written Football Battalion.
Ah, it is, isn't it?
I mean, Terry, are you allowed to swear on your podcast?
Yeah, it's clean up to now.
When I read that...
How did you feel about that?
When I read that, I mean, I could not
believe it. Shiver went down your spine, didn't it?
This is...
Because now you've connected them.
This is unbelievable.
Yeah.
Saints' first ever mixed race player is in the same battalion as the Cobblers' first mixed race. That cannot be a coincidence, surely.
I feel funny now just talking about
it. It is unbelievable.
It is, isn't it? So we think the timings are right. Their paths, because your subsequent...
They definitely would have known
cross.
Each other. They joined... Well, Frank joined in the March. January.
So Walter
January.
At this stage is an NCO.
Walter joined December. Frank joined in January.
Right.
He was actually down working in London at the time, Frank.
Okay.
Working in a shoe factory down in London. Yeah. And he joined them. It's in London. The 17th did a parade through London, a recruitment drive.
Yeah, yeah.
And he joined them at Crystal Palace, but he was still working as a shoe finisher. It's all there on his report, shoe finisher. But he was promoted to a lance corporal. I mean, it's possible within a battalion of 1,000 men you wouldn't know each other, but if you're both NCOs, you know each other.
Yeah, and you come from the same town.
It just seems inconceivable that these two men didn't. There must have been a reason he's joined with Walter Tull.
I wonder whether. He's following deliberately Walter Tull. We don't know. We're
again,
speculating, aren't we?
I remember talking to Terry Angus about this, and he because again, I'm very conscious that I'm a white middle-aged man talking about this.
Yeah.
Terry
would that
said,
be a reason to think?
Terry's view was, you would join somewhere you feel safe.
Yeah.
And he said it was the same in the 80s. I'd joined football clubs where other black players were. Because
Is
he thought,
that what
well,
he said?
Yeah. He said, well, that's where you're going to go.
Right.
So if your mates. Walter is black and in that battalion.
Yeah.
That's
you
where I'm going to go.
You want to be there with him, don't you? Yeah.
It's amazing, isn't it?
It is.
Incredible. Because Walter Tull's story is so well known.
But no one knew about this.
And here's Frank Anderson.
He told me about this a few weeks ago.
And there's more to it as well. Because he was promoted to Lance Corporal, just like Walter was promoted.
Yeah. Yeah.
He went to France around the same time, exactly the same time. And like Walter, he served at the Somme.
Right,
and you mentioned Delville Wood.
He was one of those there.
He was in Delville Wood, and he was wounded there.
Ah.
It says in his papers, let me find it for you. It says, well, it appears in the newspaper, actually. It says, let me just bear me one second. Frank Anderson here, Middlesex Regiment. His wife lives at 6 Upper Cross Street, Northampton, has been wounded but remained on duty. Look, again, evidence is definitely him. He will be remembered as a good rugby football player.
It's definitely the right
man. It's definitely our man. So he's wounded at Delville Wood.
So he comes out then. Does he come back to the UK?
He's only a minor flesh wound. Only a flesh wound. And he was appointed Lance Corporal in August 16, promoted to full corporal October 1916. But then, again, I'll refer you to his service record here. Bearing in mind all the talk about Walter Tull's medal, here we are, awarded military medal for bravery in the field. So for... his actions on the Somme at Delville Wood and it's Guillemont, he's awarded the military medal.
So Guillemont is only a few weeks after Delville Wood.
August he was
so
there.
He was back for that.
Yeah, he was there. And I mean I find that incredible.
It is.
That
And he sees out the war. He comes back to town.
Yeah, so he carries on fighting. He stays with him. He's wounded again in October 1917. It appears in the newspaper again. It says he's wounded. He played football for the Saints and worked at Long Buckby. He fractured his left ribs. Some timber rolled on him while he was moving. Helped him move some timber, and he got squashed and he broke his ribs. And that's the end of his war. Went home in October 1917 in hospital in Sheffield, back to Northampton. Saw the war out.
Well, that could well have saved his life, you know, because happened in 1918, you know.
Yeah.
More casualties in that year than all the others.
And the footballers continued to be in the thick of it. Yeah. It's not quite the end of his story, though. He lived in Northampton with his wife and his children, but he was down in London quite a lot. I think because of work, he appears in the 21 census living in London, in Elephant and Castle. He moves around a couple of addresses in the 20s, and... Well, I'm afraid it's not a happy ending for him, because in 1921, if you look in his military papers again here, it says Frank Anderson, that here he is dying on the 4th of July 1921 of tuberculosis.
So did he actually get onto the 1921 census?
He did, just.
Just.
He died in London Temperance Hospital, aged 42, on the 8th of July.
Did you say it was TB?
Yeah, TB, a poor man's disease, you know, of the... And that's the thing about the Andersons. They were very, very tough lives, very poor people. So Frank died in 1921, 4th of July 1921.
In London. So he's buried in London, is he?
Well, his burial site, which we went to with Lewis Ludlam, he's buried in St Pancras Cemetery.
Right.
Which is an enormous cemetery.
Yeah, you found his headstone, did you? There was something.
I'm afraid not. I'm afraid he's buried in a pauper's grave.
Oh, he's got a pauper's grave.
Because he was a very, very poor
man. There's nothing there. Graham showed me just a photograph of some vegetation.
It's terribly overgrown.
Yeah.
And that is the final resting place, I'm afraid, of Frank Anderson.
But again, we're talking about him. And until lockdown, until you went down there with your son.
A stroke of luck.
No one would have known about him. And that connection... With Walter, which probably hasn't been talked about before.
He'll be remembered. Saints will certainly do their bit to remember him now. Yeah. And Spring Lane Primary School, I've been there a few times. One thing I should say is that, you know, one of the difficulties, I suppose, that I faced was definitively proving that he's mixed race. It's very hard.
Because of that photo.
Yeah, and, you know, you don't want to draw too many assumptions. Yeah, and it doesn't say on the British censuses, like it does in America, what his race is. And there's no trace of his great-grandfather or his grandfather. No trace. There may well have been slaves, I suspect, in America.
Mm.
But as luck would have it, this is one thing I love about Northampton, is that people don't go very far. Mm. So I know his great-grandson. I've got to know his great-grandson quite well.
Mm.
I found him through this. And his great-grandson had photographs of Frank's daughter, his granny.
And that proves it.
And he said, look at my granny. She was black. And he said, I've always grown up understanding that we were a family with mixed heritage.
Yeah.
And he was very proud of that.
Yeah, I mean, rightly so.
And funnily enough, he didn't know...
I think everyone should be proud of their heritage.
Absolutely. It makes life interesting. Which is Martin Faulkner's point, his great-grandson. He's a season ticket holder at the Cobblers.
Right. Martin. It's gone full circle.
So he knew all about...
It's gone full circle.
He knew all about Walter Tull.
But did he know about...
He knew nothing about Frank.
Wow.
And he was thrilled to bits. And I'll tell you now, I know you're a Cobblers, you're a football man rather than rugby. I'll tell you now, the Faulkner family now do both. I've seen Martin comes down to watch the Saints wearing his Anderson shirt.
Yeah,
very
fantastic.
Proudly.
What a legacy that is.
He's got a bit of a legacy.
Yeah.
And as I say, I suppose most importantly, Spring Lane School have done an amazing job of talking about him. Saints have donated a cup to the club, Frank Anderson Cup. Which they now have a touch rugby tournament for. And
it's a primary school.
It's a primary school, which just is where Frank would have gone.
He would have done, wouldn't he?
And
it's an old building, isn't it?
It's an old building. And just like today, it is a deprived area.
Yeah, it is.
And racially diverse.
Yeah.
Ethnically diverse.
Yeah.
So it's entirely appropriate that is the focal point. Rather than the cemetery, I think, down in London, which we don't really know exactly where
it is. Well,
There's nothing there.
I'm going to go and get a picture. Of that primary school.
The focal point should be on Spring Lane. And I'm very pleased that it is being.
I'm going to do that as soon as I've left
good
here.
Man.
Well, that's a good way to end, isn't it?
Yes.
It really is.
Yeah, incredible stories.
They are.
Incredible men in their own way.
They are. And coming from a town where we're sitting, where we live here in Northampton, and every town, wherever you live throughout the world, you know, the town where you live is going to have the story's there. You just need to go and find them, don't you? Just exactly as you've done.
Hey, I've got plenty more, Terry.
If you want, have, if you
want,
loads
you, want, you want me back any time, I'll come.
If you come back, Graham, that would be fantastic. So there you go. Quite a remarkable story of two men who overcome so much in life. And in Walter's case is remembered so fondly in death, like so many of them are. So as usual this week, we'll end the podcast playing the last post in tribute to those two men. One who survived the war but died in the 1920s. And the other, of course, who died on those open fields near Bapaume in March 1918, Walter Toll.